And honestly, I think we could get rid of the entire radicalization problem if the internet just got destroyed tomorrow. It would be gone, because it's you have AI, which is able to radicalize people nonstop as a chatbot, and it can be trained in how to do that. And it's very good at it. We've already seen what AI is capable of, and kind of love bombing people outside of radicalization, just telling people, "Oh, you have figured out the mysteries of the universe. You are the most brilliant mathematical mind ever. You should get a Fields Medal." No, but AI is clearly able to do that, which is very dangerous. You can give that to bad actors who have a lot of money. They control the media spaces, and they have a vested interest in us fighting each other, because if we fight each other, we don't attack upwards. And I do think we are at a time where we are actually at war with our economic system. And, but like any good empire builders, the way to hold an empire is to make different faction of it fight each other.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast. A podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. And in this week's episode, I'm excited to share a conversation with James Stamatolos. We explore why many men struggle with the feeling of being not enough, even when they are high achieving. Drawing from his background in counterterrorism and emergency management, James offers a powerful perspective on pressure, identity, and emotional resilience. We discuss masculinity, shadow work, internal family systems, and how men can begin to move from insecurity toward integration and purpose. Some of the key themes we explore are masculinity and identity, internal family systems, shadow work, trauma and emotional patterns, purpose and self-leadership. James J. Stamatolos is a professional coach and certified level 3 internal family systems practitioner, specializing in helping men navigate anxious insecurity, the persistent feeling of not being enough. He previously worked in counterterrorism and emergency management, bringing a unique perspective on stress, resilience, and identity. Please check out all the ways you can find James online. And as always, listening to this episode does not constitute therapy. It is only for educational and informational purposes and has no affiliation with my therapy work. If you do require support, please reach out to a licensed professional. Now let's just jump right into the episode. James, welcome to Easy Conversations. I appreciate you taking the time this morning to jump on and do this. Really looking forward to our conversation. We've been able to talk more in some, I would say, more of an unfortunate circumstance with the recent passing of our dear friend, Pierre. He's been a guest on the show, and he and I have spent a lot of time talking about some of the issues that we were seeing with men. And part of the reason why you and I are chatting today is to perhaps highlight a different aspect of that. But before we get into our conversation, I just want to give you an opportunity to share with the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background, just to give us an idea of where you're coming from and why you would be someone who's well versed in talking about our topic today around, maybe just to put that out there as well, radicalization of men that we're seeing in society today.
First, Furkan, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I've really been looking forward to this with you. And well, I guess there's a few things to know about my background to make this make more sense to people. First, if we work in reverse, the way you and I know each other now is by being in a similar space of people who specialize in working with men. So I help men primarily deal with relational trauma. I'm trained as a certified level 3 IFS practitioner, internal family systems for whoever knows about that. But really, it's emotional work that's trauma-based to help men understand and engage with their emotions in new ways. Especially emotions like insecurity. The people who I tend to work with best are people who come from a background that's similar to mine, of people who feel chronically not enough no matter how much they achieve. So they always put a lot of pressure on themselves. There's a strong self-criticism. There's a constant feeling of shame that no matter what pedestal they're put on by the world around them, they themselves feel some sort of hole or void inside. Been doing this for over a decade, it's been very great and interesting work because I'm very interested in how we make decisions and how our behaviors are influenced by our emotions. Mm-hmm. And this comes from my prior work in part of working in the counterterrorism and emergency response space. So before I have been doing this work, I worked in the Office of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for the city of Pittsburgh. I was also a counterterrorism intelligence analyst for the Region 13 Counterterrorism Fusion Center Task Force. It's a very long, obnoxious name. Region 13 Counterterrorism Task Force Fusion Center. There we go. Mm. And that involved everything from looking at plans and looking at radicalization. At the time, I was really interested by Islamic radicalization. Mm. So a lot of it would be considered far right Islamic radicalization, mm-hmm. from that point of view. But we looked at anything that was a local threat. And part of the job also involved going on SWAT calls. So we would go on SWAT calls in support of the SWAT team. And there I saw over and over this pattern of men being in positions where they're in a standoff with the police, or it's a hostage situation, which is usually domestic violence. Mm. And it's all because they don't know how to deal with their feelings. Whether that ended with them being arrested or them doing suicide by cop, them doing suicide or them giving up, it was this constant pattern of these men have no idea how to deal with these strong feelings. And when I was younger, 9/11 was a major motivating factor that happened when I was 15. And that's what got me into this field. But by the time I was in my early 20s and I was going on these SWAT calls, I was dealing with my own pain and my own issues, and I was falling apart inside. And luckily, I wasn't alone in that. I had people that I could reach out to for help. I had to learn how to have a new relationship with myself. But in doing so, on the way coming out of that, I started to be more open and talk about what I was going through. And I started to realize the vast majority of people around me were going through some version of what I was too, of this kind of self-loathing, this self-hatred, and tearing our parts down. And I started to feel like the cost to society of us destroying ourselves was far higher than that of terrorists. Mm. If you think of the amount of books not being written, businesses not being created, inventions not being made, works of art not being made because they're dying with the people who hold them. Mm. Society is losing far more from us falling apart inside than it is from an external radical threat. And so that caused me to pivot, but I still have this deep yearning to understand and combat radicalization, because during 9/11, that night, whenever I was at home and I was sitting and I was watching the towers fall over and over again, watching people jump out of the towers over and over again, I became fixated on this question: what would make someone wake up and kill thousands of people they never met? And how could we have stopped that decision in advance? And now I feel like I'm at a place in my career where understanding how our relationship with our emotions impacts our behavior, it's not that big of a change between those of us who, like myself and the people I work with, where we're more motivated to cause self-pain when we feel insecure, weak. I think that's the far more common thing. But there is a sliver of society where they just turn that dial the other way. And it's no, it needs to be external. And some of this is me coming back to my roots and wanting to come back to help change this now, especially because I think in my lifetime, this is the most ripe environment for radicalization I've ever seen. And it frankly scares me.
Mm. I appreciate you sharing all of that. And there's a couple of things I wanted to come back to based on what you shared. One, what I'm hearing from you is, in the work you were doing in counterterrorism, you were able to see a commonality between perhaps even yourself and the terrorist on the other side, in terms of that person's inability to deal with the emotions.
Right.
And I think that's at times what's lacking. And it's not to excuse the behavior of others, but it's to be able to see that common thread. And unfortunately, we tend to ostracize others or otherize based on that fact that, no, they're different, there's something wrong on that side. But if we can look at that common thread, I think it can not only bring out empathy, but a compassionate side to healing everyone, including ourselves.
I think that's a great point. I completely agree. This is a soapbox I can get on for a long time, so I'm not going to. We're going to do a short version of it now, but this, some of this comes from my background in studying international affairs. So there's, we were taught this idea of called rational and irrational actors. For a rational actor, I can explain why this country is doing this thing, why this leader. An irrational actor is someone who I can't predict. And I hated these titles. And I would, I was very vocal in my classes about the fact that we are using bad language here, because if someone is an irrational actor, that is only because you lack the information to understand why their decision makes sense. I watched a friend of mine have a schizophrenic break. And it was heartbreaking on the one hand, but two, it was the thing that was hard for her was being so in such a different reality. But if I would accept her reality, if I would try to be curious of what is she going through, and I had the sensation she was having, everything she was doing made rational sense. She was taking rational behaviors based on what she was facing. And so whenever we are faced with someone doing something terrible, I think the easy thing, the thing that politicians do, which I also despise, is saying they hate us because of who we are. That is a propaganda. No one who works in this field would ever say anything like that because it's just a flat out lie. Every terrorist organization has a legitimate grievance. They have something that is a proper issue. You can tie 9/11 to troops being in the Islamic Holy Lands. You can, there are, they wanted foreign troops out. They had specific policy goals. And that's one of the things for terrorism that defines terrorism from extreme violence is terrorism always has a political goal. It has to have a political goal. Otherwise, it's not terrorism. But the this is to bring this all back. The point is everything that everyone does somehow makes sense if you are willing to do the work to be curious and try to find out what is their point of view, which doesn't mean you have to agree with it, but you have to accept that this is a rational human being who is just as smart as me and who is just as educated. Like terrorists, for example, though a lot of people believe they're crazy or they're insane, not true. They have in many ways better mental health than the average population. Engineers are overrepresented. Doctors are overrepresented. These are often people that come from higher middle class, low upper class backgrounds. They feel very, they see a pain in the world that they have reached the point where they think the only way to deal with this pain is through violence. That is a defining aspect for them. It is not because they are crazy, and you have to be curious enough to understand, even if to understand what their point of view is, because again, I do not have to agree with it, but I do have to know that there is some rational reason for how they got to where they got to.
Yeah. And I was recently reading a book where they were talking about the 9/11 attacks, and I didn't appreciate this at the time, or perhaps even until recently. And what they were, the case they were making was part of Osama bin Laden's grievance was what was going on in Palestine. So that was a huge motivating factor for him. Again, not to excuse the behavior or the choices that were made, but to your point of, okay, if we understand what is the grievance, that just gives us more insight.
Yeah, and I was just at a training where we were getting a presentation by the FBI on these things, and they brought the same point up. There is always a grievance. There is always a legitimate, there is some legitimate issue here, and you have to be curious about what that is, always.
Now, some people can make the argument, which I can understand, is we don't necessarily have the time to sit around and understand the grievance if we're at risk. And maybe that's the case that's being made recently with what's been going on over the last 3 weeks with the war in Iran. Now, how do you reconcile that argument?
I think that's a lazy argument.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I can say more, but that's just being lazy.
Right.
Try harder.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we'll come back to the fear piece. That's probably going to be a main focus of what we're going to talk about today. So I want to pin that for now. But there was another thing you talked about, and perhaps maybe for everyone to really understand, what is relational trauma, right?
Sure. So obviously, given your background, if you want to add anything to this, feel free to. But the way it's always been presented to me is we have, I don't like these titles, big T and little T trauma, where like a big T trauma is like some big event where it's like a car accident, I think is the most common thing related to PTSD. But it's, you have car accidents, you have acts of war, you have rapes, you have something very intense that's very overwhelming, and the person was isolated or incapacitated at the time. So that's, I think, what a lot of us think about when we think of trauma. But there's also this little T trauma, and I don't like the name because it makes it seem less impactful.
Correct.
But in my experience, this is some, like the harder thing to work with, because it's often repeated over and over again, where there's this message of shame that is constantly delivered through the relationships I'm in. So humans are hypersocial animals. I forget what paper I read, but it was brilliant how they put it, where they opened the paper by saying almost all animals and plants on Earth are built to excel in a certain environment. Mm. And you can't move them. Something that's made to, that has adapted to function really well in the Amazon, you can't take it to the Sahara. Mm. Like this is a great thing, but it needs to be in the right place. Humans, on the other hand, have been, go everywhere. They don't need to be in a single good environment, but the one environment they thrive in is a human environment with human connections. Mm. So that is our working definition of safety, is feeling like we are properly safe in our relationships, because that is how we as a species define safety. Mm. So people with relational trauma come from a background where they have somehow, through the way they were treated by others, somehow adopted the message that there is something inherently wrong with me. If it is discovered, I will be rejected. I will be exiled. Mm. So I have to hide something in me. I have to fix something in me. I need to transform something in me. And it's not so much about wanting to be at the top. It's that I don't want to be at the bottom. And I'm constantly trying to escape rejection. And so if you find yourself constantly in that loop, and that's the loop that gets people trapped, for especially people who try to achieve their way out of it, which is what I did, and that was what my clients typically do, it gets scary because I keep trying to achieve, and it doesn't matter what I do, I still have that hole. And oh my God, then is my worst fear true? Is it true that I'm just irrevocably broken, that there's something wrong with me? And luckily, no, this is just relational trauma. We can work with it. We can help you address those parts of yourself and bring them some healing and connections. They don't feel separated. But that is how I look at it personally.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that little T, big T kind of classification undermines someone's experience. And it's subjective, right? Yeah. What may be little T for me might be big T for you, and vice versa, right? So I think I agree with you on that front. So you talked about the exile piece, which probably feeds into the work you do in IFS.
Right.
Now, I relate to what you're sharing, because my coping mechanism was through achievements. While that's served me well, it's the whole concept of the shadow work too, right? How do you integrate that into your life? So how have you been able to help others, especially, I think that's not to generalize, but I see that a lot in men where achievements is a way of feeling more than enough and navigating shame. But how do you then work with that if you're struggling with that?
So I love the IFS or the parts work way of approaching this, because it's one, helps us organize things without taking sides. We can notice that there is a part of you that is trying to help you achieve. There's probably also part of you that thinks this is hopeless and thinks you need to give up. And there's maybe another part of you that is maybe a perfectionist and believes it has to be perfect or it doesn't count at all. And there's a part of you in the middle of this that feels inherently worthless. And so we can help you organize your feelings in this way, and then help you build relationships with these different parts of yourself. So for me, I think of as parts work as, or IFS is like active meditation, where if you think of normal mindfulness meditation is more as a passive observing approach, we take that. We see what is here without judgment. We try to just notice and acknowledge what is here. But we go a step further to realize that you are conscious being aware of, let's say, the part of you that feels inherently worthless. Does that part of you that feels worthless, does it know that there is a conscious being here with it? And we can actually form a relationship with it. And guess what? That's the problem. The problem is that it feels isolated. So we're coming in from the very beginning with a solution. We can provide it with a solution with you yourself, which means you can carry it all the time. You don't have to go once a week for it. You don't have to go to a special place for it. You can build a relationship with the part of you that has felt exiled and isolated and alone. Mm. And that is a transformational experience.
Yeah.
So that is the long game. That can be a short process. That can be a long process. It depends on how guarded we are, our backgrounds. But there's no one I've met for whom I believe, oh, this, there's no way we can do this. It's a very powerful tool when it's used well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with you. And coming back to the whole grievance narrative, one of the things when you and I last chatted, you'd mentioned that there is a parallel to suicidal ideation. Are you able to touch on that a little bit more? And I do want to now perhaps get into some of the things you're seeing as well. But yeah, absolutely. Just touching on that parallel there.
So I think there's two ways we can see commonalities. The first is how we as a society think about this topic. And the second is how we think about the people around us and what they're going through. So we can think of radicalization, to share some of the things that were the FBI shared with us in a recent training, as we can think of it as an arc or a process that starts with, this is a problem and it needs to be changed. And then maybe we go so far, we hear someone saying, this is a problem, it needs to be changed, and violence is an answer for it. And we can stay there a really long time, or we can go, and not everyone will make this final leap, but we can go to the point where we can say, this is a problem, it needs to be changed, violence is justified, and I am the person to do this. Mm. And so I see a similar arc in how people talk about being suicidal. And I remember this from when I was suicidal early on, of there is a big difference between I'd be okay not waking up tomorrow, and here's my plan, I'm going to execute on it. And you can hear a change in how people talk. So if we think about the commonalities here, one, we as a society have finally come to terms that suicidality is a thing that does not need to be hidden, that it's actually something that requires engagement. Mm-hmm. And we need to think of radicalization as the same thing. This isn't something that we should see as embarrassing if we, especially because so many teenagers are radicalized, that's actually the most at-risk group right now. These are people who do not have a prefrontal cortex fully formed. They are still in a very emotional state that is being exploited. It's really under 18 is the people who are most being targeted. That is not a shameful thing. That is a sign that we need to give people help. And the other part of it is listening for that difference in language. Is this someone saying that they'd just be okay to not be here? Is this someone signaling that they're ready to take action to end their life? Same thing. Is someone just giving a grievance about something happening in the world that is legitimately bad? Or are they saying that they are getting ready to take action, they are arming themselves, and they're willing to cause harm for a quote-unquote higher good?
Yeah. And talking about that demographic where maybe adolescent boys are the most vulnerable to it, there's tons of research that has gone into understanding that in terms of how boys get recruited into gangs, into terrorism, all of that. How much of relational trauma also plays into that?
Massive. I think we can first look at almost all of the leaders, what Hitler, Stalin, like all of them were either abused or molested, or they had some issues with their fathers. You can just look across the board at who have been leaders of extreme violence, and almost all of them have some major form of relational trauma. Mm. And some of them, all of them have in some way decided, among many other things, that the way to stop feeling small is to overpower others. Mm. And there's a realization you sometimes hit, especially when you study terrorism, that the worse the warlord is, the more of a crybaby they are. Like these are very self-focused, woe is me, just pity parties. Like they're very self-absorbed in their pain. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously not that people who have relational trauma become violent. I have that background, so clearly not. It's there is a population where maybe if you were also exposed to abuse, if you were also to physical violence a lot, or if you were exposed to other things, or I don't know, maybe there are just people who are pure evil, but I always view that as a scapegoat or just as a lazy answer. But sometimes I look at things and it's hard not to feel that way, especially with some of the things we see in the radical, in the online radical space of just nihilism, just wanting to destroy the human race. I mean, where does that come from? So I think to bring this back, because I always separate these things in my mind, I separate leaders from followers. So right now, so far, I've been talking about leaders. Followers I see different. I have a lot more compassion for followers because they have a problem they are trying to solve, and these leaders are bad actors who are giving them a bad solution. The followers are here because they're looking for things. They're looking for a sense of belonging. They're looking for a sense of purpose. They're looking for a place where they feel like they have some value in the world and someone values them. And that's why a lot of times in the radicalization process, there's something called love bombing, where they will be constantly complimented. Someone will be saying to them, oh, you're so smart. You see this so clearly. You see the injustice. You're ready to take action. You're so amazing. And that's often missing from their life. So just being aware that's part of the radicalization process, it also shows how we can deal with this, because the solution to radicalization in many ways is connection. These people are finding connection that is going to harm them and harm others. Let's offer them connection that allows them to thrive and allows them to be, to grow and to be strong and to be surrounded by others instead of isolating and being by themselves.
Yeah. And you're touching on so many things, so I'm going to try to keep track of everything, but there's a lot here for sure. Now, one of the things that was coming up for me as you were sharing that, and it's not always possible, but what, to me, I hear that there's an even more prominent role for fathers in society, where I think that's been almost minimized in a way. At least that's been my observation. But to when I hear that is when these young men are being targeted in a way or being given the sense of purpose that they may be lacking. And to your point, the love bombing. That can be fulfilled in such a healthy way with healthy fathers in the picture, which becomes a bit of a circular argument, because even fathers are damaged in a way, or they've experienced their relational trauma and they're passing that on to their children. But what can we then do to further emphasize this role of fathers in society? And what are your thoughts? I know I shared my view on how it's been minimized. And in some cases, fathers are being alienated or estranged from their children as well, which is a separate issue. But yeah,
I think there's a lot of ways to come to this. First, I'm not a father, but I completely agree. I would add uncles to this.
Yeah.
I think it needs to be more of a, I think the way that I would look at this is by thinking about men, in my experience, men thrive when they feel like they're part of a team. So if we want our boys to feel like they're part of a team, we as men have to be part of a team. So I think a lot of this is modeling. Instead of us telling our boys how to be or how to act, it should be more of us modeling things. So what do they watch us as older men? How do they watch us engage with each other? Do they watch us going to each other for help? Do they watch us offering help? Do they watch us being the things that we tell them we value? Because if the answer is to that no, then it doesn't matter what we say, they're not going to do it. So to me, I think to make this more concrete, there was, I was part of an organization that they wanted to create the coming of age ceremony for boys. And they were so focused on what the boys were going to go through. And I felt like I was in the back of the room trying to be a squeaky wheel saying, this means nothing if the fathers and uncles haven't gone through it too. You go through a coming of age to join a club. If that club doesn't exist to begin with, what are they joining? Like that is missing. So I think the club aspect of men, which was the norm for ages, even in the United States, of men working together, men working hard whenever they were expanding out west, there was the idea of personal tools wasn't really a thing. if I had a saw, why would you buy one? Like, that just doesn't make sense. Like, my tools are your tools. There was always this inherent assumption that we all need to lean on each other. So whatever we can bring, but it's communal. Mm-hmm. So much was communal. Men used to even go on honeymoons with their best friends. Like, we used to have so much more connection as men. And at some point in the 50s, this became like this lone wolf mentality, which has completely destroyed men. And in my experience, there's no basis to explain how that helps men. Because everything I look at for when we see from landing on the moon to crossing the oceans to curing diseases has always happened when people work in teams. Why do we think it's any different in our own life? So to bring this all to a close, are the fathers and uncles acting as if they're part of a team? If the answer is no, can that get fixed so that the boys see what it's like for men to act like they're part of a team and to lean on each other and to offer help to each other?
And I think part of what we've been touching on and off is the shame piece. And I think shame causes us to isolate, right? And not feel comfortable or have the courage to even ask for help. And I think that's one of the things we're trying to break down here. The other thing you touched on was your own relational trauma, and that didn't cause you to turn to violence. So what were the things that you did? I know you've touched on some of them, but to put it into more of a direct way, what did you do to help you overcome relational trauma from your perspective and perhaps shift into a healthier way where you're supporting other men rather than causing damage?
So I think the best way to start is to tell this story is to start at the beginning. So I was in my early 20s. I was suicidal. I felt like I was looking at the future and it seemed like all black. And because of my field, I could not go to therapy. It was always proposed as a threat to me, because if I had a diagnosis, there were entire career things I couldn't move on. I was just starting my career. And so I reached out to someone for help who just happened to be a friend and mentor at this point. He was an Irish Catholic priest. I was very firmly agnostic atheist at the time. But that didn't matter. We just got along because we were friends. And I told him my predicament. I was just asking for help because I knew he worked with other guys. And he said, why don't you just come to my office on this date? And that was not the answer I wanted at all. But I said, I don't really have another option. So I went and we sat down. It was a Saturday. And he just looked at me and he said, I want you to tell me every single reason you hate yourself. And it was like a dam being opened where for an hour and a half, I just this and this and this and just like everything, like things I'd forgotten, things I completely blocked from my mind. And it felt like it literally felt like someone took fire pokers and was just jabbing them in and out of my sternum and out of my torso over and over again. Until I reached, after an hour and a half, he just asked minimal questions just to keep me going. I'm looking down at this like wad of tissues filled with tears, snot, and everything else. And I realize what I'd just done, and my brain came back on and I said, what the fuck did you just do? Like, you've known this guy for 8 years. He's a friend and mentor. You've told him things you haven't told another person. How is he going to respond? And I just looked up and he looked at me and he said, is that everything? And I said, yes. And for the first time in all of this, he had a reaction where this huge smile flashed across his face. He leapt out of his chair, came over to me, gave me a big hug, and he just said, I love you. And I just broke down all over again. And that moment saved my life, not so much in that he saved my life, but more I once again became fascinated by a question that seemed a question about something that seemed so insane to me, where this man has seen everything terrible in me and he has still chosen to offer love. Why can he do that for me, but I can't do that for myself? And I became fixated on that question. And it was really one, understanding there is such a thing as a self-relationship, that I could listen to the way I talk to myself, the words I use, the tone I use. I can see, why am I doing this? Can I replace that with something? Can I know this when it's coming up? I realized that my self-relationship set the foundation for everything else in my life, from the work I was doing to the people I was relating to the women I was pursuing. Everything had to do with this. Mm-hmm. And as that shifted, everything else started to shift too. And so I became interested in the self-relationship aspect. And I was drawn to coaching, again, in part because therapy wasn't, I didn't have the best experiences, even as a client, a few times I tried to do it later on and a few other things. But I was drawn to coaching because coaching makes this assumption that the client is already inherently strong, mm-hmm. capable, and wise. And if there is no sense of we're going to fix you, it's more we're just going to look at your patterns and give you new patterns. And I know that there's many branches of therapy that have that view, mm-hmm. but I did not know that at the time. And so I got into coaching, and I started to do coaching the way I was taught, which was very CBT-ish, mm-hmm. very heavy in that direction. But over time, I started to realize the same thing that worked for me was working for others. When we looked at it from a relational standpoint, people were starting to change things in their life that they weren't even focused on, where they would say, if instead of I'm going to really focus on changing what I eat, it was more, if I change my starting point, where my starting point is I am the steward to myself, my job is to make the best possible choices for what I consume, that started to change the media they consumed, that started to change the food they consumed, the people they were around, all just by changing their starting point based on their self-relationship. Mm-hmm. So there's so many things that could change just based on that. And it was really addressing my own relational trauma of seeing myself as something I wanted to destroy. I now got to this new idea of what would happen if I saw myself as an ally I want to help instead of an enemy I want to defeat. Mm. And that has been transformational.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's so much power in just in that story, but generally speaking, what a lot of these younger men need at times is first being able to ask for help and having the people that are around them that can offer that help, right. and are not predators, and that sense of connection. And what I see a lot of the times, I agree with you 100%. It starts with the self. Being able to connect with oneself is such an important aspect of my day-to-day, but it's such a foreign concept when I'm working with men because they're, and I can appreciate why, but they're so wired to look at external metrics, and you add social media into that mix and it just blows everything up further. But that connection to self is where if they're able to connect to themselves, they can have much, much healthier relationships with their children, with their spouses, family, friends, everyone. But unfortunately it's lacking in so many areas.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of this comes down to the experience of being a man. I think one of the things that I think men inherently get that in my experience, women don't have as much of a lived experience of, and I say this with some degree of hesitation, mm-hmm. is this feeling of being a man is something, it's a game that's always in process. It's always in play. There's my value as a man feels like it's in play. At least that's a common feeling for a lot of the men I work with, where like we have this idea of a man card that you earn or you can lose your level of man, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And so when we feel like we're low on the totem pole and we feel like we're in an active game where we can be pushed off the field or kicked out and we don't want that to happen, we start to look at how do I get points? Where are the ways I get points? Mm-hmm. And if we're growing up in America or if we're growing up in a society that is materialistic to a degree, we see things like flashy cars. We see things like all the things that young guys are interested in because they are this mean if the women I date or the cars I drive or where I live or the amount of money I have, like that is something that if you are insecure, looks amazing. And if you are secure, looks foolish. But it makes perfect sense if you are at the very bottom, you look at that and you say, look, this is someone who has climbed up the ladder. I want to climb up the ladder too. I'm going to follow them. And so I do think that men put a lot of pressure on themselves to achieve in part because our society has said to a degree, this is how you get your values as a man. Mm. And I do need to say that I have worked with women too. Even though I am primarily a men's coach, they seek me out. They have the exact same issue. They feel like their self-worth is based on what they achieve on top of all the things I deal with as a woman. So this isn't really gender split, but I do think that a lot of men have, I don't know, there's a sense of loss that of being less of a man that I think is a threat that's always there. Mm-hmm. And that has to somehow be part of this conversation to acknowledging that.
Yes, yes. And to perhaps expand on that, I know you touched earlier that questioning whether there's true evil or is it just a sense of nihilism. And part of that is I feel when men, if we're speaking about men generally here, but if they feel like there's no meaning to their existence or life, it's easy to fall into that trap. The other side of it where I agree with you, you've shared it before, but not in this conversation so far, is the hedonism side of it too. And getting misdirected in either way. I know there was a part of my life where I would almost swing back and forth, seek out hedonistic activities, and then feel a sense of nihilism the next morning. And until I didn't discover for myself what my purpose in life was and how I gave it meaning, I couldn't get out of that cycle of back and forth. And yeah, it was just brutal, but I could see how people fall into that trap. So to your point, I don't necessarily know if there's evil. You can make the case based on history and what we've seen over time, especially even now. But yeah, I just wanted to add that piece around that if that meaning is taken away.
I think that's important because even if you look at the people driving a lot of the nihilistic behavior in the radicalization space, they're doing it because they're looking for meaning and belonging. Mm. You have people who are trying to encourage young kids to take pictures of themselves naked so that they can be blackmailed, often encouraging to, I want you to cut my name into you, or encouraging them to commit suicide. And they will have boards where they rank, like, this is how many people I was able to get to commit suicide. I was able to get these people to do this. And they're using other people, but they're finding belonging in their own nihilistic, violent space of, wow, he was able to really get someone to destroy themselves. That's really impressive. I want to outdo him. Like, they are still looking for the same things in a completely grotesque, destructive way. But those basic wants are still there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So perhaps now talking about something you shared right at the beginning, that we're in a time right now where society perhaps has been primed for radicalization, and it's not the type that we've been hearing about for the last two decades. It's probably closer to home. Are you able to talk about how, and perhaps we've already laid the groundwork here already, but how is society now primed for radicalization?
I think society is primed for radicalization because of at least two things. Maybe more. We'll see how this goes. The first is we are living in the most socially disconnected time in world history for people who live in developed nations. That's isolation is always, it's just super fertile soil for getting people to do stuff, because every human, like we, to go back at the beginning, we define safety by belonging. So if we feel really desperate to belong in someone, it's like being really thirsty for water. If you are dying of thirst and someone hands you mud water, you will drink it because you are desperate for water. I'm not going to hold out for the nice clear water because I don't know if it's going to come. So if we have a very disconnected time, that's fertile soil for someone to come and offer us bad water, but we're desperate for water. The second thing I will add is we are in a time of extreme uncertainty and change. The entire world is changing and it will not go back to how it is. That's very confusing. No one knows what's going to happen. We have new technologies coming in that are completely changing the questions we ask ourselves, where you have, like, is to put it, everything has gotten more complex. That to give a tangential analogy to this, I remember talking to one of my friend's moms who said, when I was little, we just wondered what neighborhood in Pittsburgh we want to live in. You guys have to decide what country. Like, everything is uncertain, and there's so many options, and that becomes overwhelming. And radical groups offer very clear black and white, no, we have it all figured out. Just join us. We got you. Mm-hmm. And there's comfort in feeling like, oh, this is all it is. These are the good people. These are the bad people. And I get to be part of the good people. This is simplifying. It gives me belonging and it makes things make sense. And I think the last thing to name is we have more opportunities for manipulation than ever before, especially because we spend so much time on screens.
Mm.
And honestly, I think we could get rid of the entire radicalization problem if the internet just got destroyed tomorrow.
Mm.
It would be gone because it's, you have AI, which is able to radicalize people nonstop as a chatbot, and it can be trained in how to do that. And it's very good at it. We've already seen what AI is capable of and kind of love bombing people outside of radicalization, just telling people, oh, you have figured out the mysteries of the universe. You are the most brilliant mathematical mind ever. You should get a Fields Medal. No. But AI is clearly able to do that, which is very dangerous. You can give that to bad actors who have a lot of money. They control the media spaces and they have a vested interest in us fighting each other, because if we fight each other, we don't attack upwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think we are at a time where we are actually at war with our economic system.
Mm.
And, but like any good empire builders, the way to hold an empire is to make different faction of it fight each other.
Yes.
So as long as they're fighting each other, they will not look to you. And that is not a good place to be. So we all need to be aware that we are all actively under attack.
Mm.
And people are constantly trying to manipulate us through our emotions. And like, even for me, I have been fooled many times by clickbait and me reacting to misinformation and fake things that are built to poke my buttons. And I now have started to watch myself where if I read something online and it makes me angry before I critically think, I have to stop and take a step back and say, is this really real? Is this right? Or am I being manipulated right now? If my emotions are up for grabs, I'm not thinking rationally. I need to be aware for that.
Yeah. I just wanted to share something. I was listening to a podcast last week. It had a former CIA agent, Gavin De Becker, and he made a very interesting analogy just to build off of what you shared. But he was talking about the king and queen. When they're looking at their subjects, they're like, we want them to fight each other because they know what separates the subjects from them is just a wall, and the wall is there, and it can be, people can climb the wall. So to your point, if we're fighting amongst each other, we're not necessarily looking at the bigger picture and understanding what's at play, which can then perhaps introduce some conspiracy theories. And that, unfortunately, when we label something a conspiracy theory, we dismiss it as well. And then unfortunately, we don't look at the truth that may be in there, because there's always some sort of truth in there. So you're talking about manipulation. You're talking about the division, looking at others, the whole, you touched on propaganda. There's a lot of social psychology at play here when we even use in-group, out-group dynamics. How do we become aware of this? Because to your point, social media is playing a significant role, and we're training the algorithm to feed us information that is going to serve our perspective and our views. So it's hard to get out of that echo chamber truly. And how do you do that?
Turn off your device. Like, there's, I feel like there are answers we can give about how to use our devices better. I also feel like it's a conversation that sounds a lot like, let's talk about how to use crack in a healthy way. Like, really? You want to use crack? As like, it's so easy. It's so designed against us. We need better regulations. And, but they have done a brilliant job in Silicon Valley of pairing regulations with freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And that, oh no, if the millionaires are regulated, we're all going to be regulated. And this is the loss of freedom, which is insanity to me. Because that's the same thing as saying, I can make the same arguments about why we shouldn't have red lights or stop signs. Who thinks that the government should tell you what you should do on the roads that you pay for? And you can almost say, yeah, that's right. I should be able to do whatever I want on the road I'm on. Okay, do you want to drive on that road where everyone else thinks the same thing? No. What would happen? You would not drive. What would happen then? You lose your freedom and mobility out of fear. So we need regulations, but and we need to fight for those. And there are organizations fighting for it. I'm a big fan of what Signal has been doing. I'm a big fan of the AFF. I think I'm getting that right. There's organizations who are trying to fight for better regulations and to protect privacy and to fight against AI and all of these things. But I think for people, which is where I'm assuming you're going with this question, I think there's two things. One, we have to realize that the more time we spend either learning about other people or engaging with other people through a screen is usually the worse we are going to feel. Mm-hmm. We have to have real life face-to-face time with other humans. That's what we are built for. We need that. In the same way that we need exercise, and sitting around all day is not good for us. Mm-hmm. It's something our ancestors had freely. We have to choose to do it. We have to view this the same way. We need to view social time as like a need that we feel, in the same way of, here are my exercise hours during the week. Here are my social hours. Mm. And they need to be with real life humans. And hopefully we will be able to talk to these people, not stay in bubbles.
Right.
Or at least not do the same thing. And the other thing we have to be aware of is, to your point, to know that we are being targeted, and to step back and maybe think, if I'm ever in a position where someone is telling me this is my enemy, I have to be curious who benefits from this being my enemy. And step back, and that allows us to start to think about, is there a way I'm being manipulated? And in my experience, the answer to this always is the shareholding billion, the top 1% that's literally standing behind the president at the inauguration here in the US, and that's running things. Like, it's, if there is a group, it's not even the CEOs, it's the shareholders behind them. Mm-hmm. It's, let's keep everything going. Yeah, those are starting points, but so much of this can be solved by just reconnecting with other humans and going back to just what it means to just be human, engaging mm-hmm. with each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think part of my frustration has been, in order for that social connection to happen, we need to be able to engage in dialogue and have an open conversation, where having that humility that we don't have all the answers. How can I listen to you, what you have to say, and learn from you, and perhaps even get a different perspective? And unfortunately, in my experience, and I've mentioned this to you as well, is that's not there right now. And it's tough. How do you open yourself up if you're not willing to listen?
That's true. I will say, I think this is another thing that happens more in online spaces than in real life. Mm-hmm. I think we're a bit more
correct
open or accepting of different viewpoints in real life, because the consequence of just lighting someone up are a lot different.
Yes.
So I do agree. I also think it's something to realize that the norms that are established online are different than the norms in day-to-day life. And if we spend more time in that, we can be more open. But to your point, I think we do need to, I think all of us have the assumption, and this goes back to being online, we all want, in the same way we want high-calorie foods, mm-hmm. we all want to feel like we're right. And tech companies are happy to make yeah. us feel like we're right, if that means we'll spend more time on their platforms just so they can shove more ads down our throats. So we have to be aware that, to some degree, we have created this monster that we want to be put in bubbles. We want to be put in echo chambers. And we want to see us as smart, us as having the obvious answer, and all those people being either evil or stupid or bad or misinformed. And we have to realize that this is something that's happened, but we don't, I guess, more humility. We have to be more humble to be aware that we don't have all the answers. Obviously not. Something I find myself saying to remind myself of this is, of course I know what they should do. I have all the answers. That's why my life is so perfect.
Right.
Which is clearly not true. Mm-hmm. So it's, can we have more humility to meet other people who hold different views, with the assumption there must be a reason. There must be a reason why you hold the view you do. And can I be curious enough to get more to that point and find out how it benefits you to have this view? Does it relate to what you've gone through in life? Does this relate to you having connection to a group? Does this relate to something else? And there are video series online I've been seeing around people from very different sides coming together mm-hmm. to have these conversations. And there are places like that. I can't remember the one off the top of my head. I'll send it to you maybe afterwards to include in the show notes so someone can see what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. A great series that seems to do this in a healthy way. which, because those people that sit in their circle, I don't think, I don't like that. That's not normal. But yeah, some more humility in assuming other people have reasons, I think, is important.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you talked about having that emotional trigger, which I think leads to a lot of those reactions and shutting down, because as you were talking about the prefrontal cortex too, but even the same thing happens when we're emotional, our brain just goes into fight or flight, and we're not able to discern information. We're not able to even absorb things. So responding in emotion is obviously an immediate sign that we need to step back and maybe let some time pass and then absorb everything. But along the conversation of emotions, fear is definitely a driving force. How are you seeing fear being used to get men to fall into these patterns of picking sides and perhaps opening them up for radicalization?
Great, great question. So I'm going to answer the fear question first. I'm going to touch on something that came up for me while you were talking.
Sure.
So that, to touch on the fear piece, I think what I see a lot of is fear that either their group is going to experience harm if they don't do something, their whatever they define as their community is somehow being hurt, and they as men need to step up and do something. I've also seen content that is based around causing fear for themselves, that they will somehow lose status or fall behind, or some enemy group will outperform them, which is slightly different, because now this is way more of a you will lose too way of looking at things. And we have data supporting or research showing that the feeling of loss of my status can be a driver for this. Fear that, I think there's also nihilism and fear aren't too far apart, because it can almost be that the fear is so overwhelming that turns to hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And you have young kids looking at a future that in many ways will be worse than the past. I think this is in many metrics of things with climate change is, and I say this as someone who used to be very conservative and who used to be in many aspects a climate denier. Climate change is going to wreck things at an unbelievable level. And the only people who profit from us not talking about it are oil companies. But anyway, that aside, we have to be curious about the fear that these people hold. And this takes me to where one of the places I want to go, because let's say we have a listener who appreciates all this, but they see something happening and they want to know, what should I do? And to be honest, I would say, one, we don't have a perfect answer for you yet, but two, I think that we have some guidelines. And some of the guidelines I would say is, to your point, we should address the emotion first.
Mm.
So think about if you have a kid who's really scared that there's a monster in the closet. If we were rational beings, what would make sense is for us to go in and say, little Johnny, no one has ever seen a monster. There's no evidence to know that they exist. Right. We can look inside it, see no monster. And Johnny would say, oh my God, my beautiful father, thank you so much for giving me this great data. Because of your data, I now feel fine. Right. Never has happened in the history of humans.
Right.
But if we went and we first attended the emotion, if we were just sat with them and said, I will be with you in your fear. I will be with you and I will help you feel connected and feel safe first. Then maybe we can talk about what's really going on. I think that's what we have to do here. So if we have someone who is repeating a grievance about the world, who is stuck in that grievance narrative of this is terrible and it needs to change, I would be really curious about, hey, it sounds like you're in pain.
Mm.
And I get that. What about this really pokes at you? What about this is the pain point for you? Is there a way this relates to your personal life, something you're going through? Does this relate to something else that, like, can we talk about your feelings before I go to something like, that's not how the world works. That's not how tariffs work. That's not how the this or that works. We're just going to end up fighting our feelings again. So if humans are emotional first creatures, which I think we are, then we should attend to the emotion first. And we might have to sit with someone while they still hold maybe radical views for a while. But what our goal in that time is to, one, make them realize they're not alone, and two, attend to their feelings and be just curious. And we don't have to agree, What we have to understand is that they are suffering. Their suffering at some level was real. They don't have to be alone in it. And can we just have company with them? Like, to finish this, I was talking to one of the feds at this presentation, and we were talking about, I was saying to him that I think there needs to be better guidance for how to help people. And he agreed, and we talked, and he said, one of the most brilliant de-radicalization events I ever saw was a cop who befriended a kid, and he just got pizza every Friday. They didn't even talk about the things this kid was talking about, the violent things. He just gave this kid company, and the kid completely changed after a few months.
Mm.
It really comes down to connection and attending to emotion.
Yes, yes. And you talked about the war is truly against the economic systems. Are you able to elaborate on that further? Because I think it ties back to the fear piece and some of the conversations we're hearing about migrants coming in and maybe taking over your jobs, or because of them, house prices are skyrocketing. So there's a lot of fear embedded in that. But what I'm understanding from you is it's truly the economic system.
I think so, because I think that's just what we're living in. I think we're in a time where we are living in a time where there is unprecedented extraction. So being from Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh has a long history of industrial superpowers using labor and using people and beating labor unions, trying to destroy all of those things. But even those people, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Carnegie in particular, who I think is beloved in Pittsburgh, but in reality, not the best person in the world. Lots of rough things that he was very careful about his public image, but they knew there was a social contract where if you give to me, or you allow me to take is better, a better way to put it. If you allow me to take, I'm going to give something back. And he was very big on libraries and things like that, to his credit. I'm a big fan of the Carnegie Library here in Pittsburgh. There was this contract that started to come that if you let me take, I will to some degree give back. And that's completely gone now. The current billionaire class has no interest in that. And there's so much extraction that's happening. And it's all things that could be solved by regulations, but they've like infested so much of government that between that and allowing people to turn on each other, it doesn't have to go to them. So at least in America, in the 1980s was when we adopted the new economic system that can be referred to as neoliberalism, where it's high competition, get rid of social safety net. We need to push people more and more. And this had, in my mind, impacts to how we educate. Everything became far more about individual competition, which is not a good setting for humans. Humans are built to thrive in team competition. We like, but we want to be in teams. And you can even look at research that's done on the mental health of athletes, where even though athletes have better mental health in general than a normal population, individuals, people who compete in individual sports have worse outcomes, generally speaking, than those in team sports. And so we see these same patterns where we're told to fight individually. It's getting very hard to succeed. Prices are going up. This is not being caused by the migrants. It's not being caused by immigrants. It's not being caused by any of this, but they're a great, easy scapegoat. And instead of looking at who benefits from this, the people that benefit from this are the ones who benefit the most from the status quo. Because every time we have an economic disaster, they get to go on a shopping spree on a discount. They get to take even more power. And it's just to bring this to a close, because I can talk about this for a while, because this was a big change for me. And it only became through doing this research that I really realized this is the way things were. The IMF, International Monetary Fund, put out a report years ago saying, does neoliberalism work? Because they are one of the largest proponents of it worldwide. And the report basically said, no, we have not succeeded at increasing economic freedom and prosperity. What we have succeeded at is allowing money to move easily across borders, and we've increased the rate of economic crises. And every time you have an economic crisis, though, you have to hear at the same time that allows people in power to gain even more power, because everything is on discount. They get to go shopping, and then they build more, wait for the next crisis, go on a shopping spree. And every time that happens, which has been happening more and more, they assert more power, and then we're left with crumbs, and we're fighting each other over crumbs.
Yeah, that's it reminds me of a study that was conducted in, I believe, the 70s by Muzaffar Sharif. I can't remember the name, but is they had these adolescent boys in a camp type of setup, and they split these boys into two groups. And basically, they told them to compete for some limited amount of resources. So they were very hostile towards each other. But when they combined the group together and gave them a shared sense of purpose or goals, they actually came together and worked things out. So I think that just shows how humans, to your point, can come together and work together if they're given a shared sense of purpose rather than told that, hey, you only have these limited resources you need to fight each other for.
And to, for what it's worth, I think that is our baseline setting. Coming from an emergency response background, one of my things that I loved most about disasters, which is maybe a very weird thing to say, was how they destroy any social stratification. So I was in Vegas during the Harvest Festival shooting, still, thankfully, hope it stays this way, the worst mass shooting in America.
Mm.
And the next morning, there was Mandalay Bay, there was the airport, then there was where we were staying. So I even heard the sirens, but living in the south side of Pittsburgh for years, sirens don't bother me. Went to sleep, woke up, found out what happened. We got to the blood bank because we heard they needed blood. We got to the blood bank at 8:30 a.m. There were so many people that came to donate blood in Las Vegas that our place in line to donate blood didn't reach the front of the building. And this isn't even to donate. This is just to put our name on the list to donate until 4:30 p.m.
Wow.
Everyone stopped what they were doing and came to help. People from every background, people wearing different political stuff. There were even politicians who came to take advantage of it, as they will. But there was a woman, I think one of the things that hit me most, there was a mother who came who said in tears almost, I just didn't know what to do. So I made 200 peanut butter jelly sandwiches for everyone here. Like, people are dropping off waters. People are coming to like, we built a whole city here. And it was a beautiful representation of this is how people actually are built to function. And when you give people the chance to come together and fight, most people choose first to come together. But to your point, if you put them in a system where success is determined on competition, that change. We have been put in a system that has been becoming more and more competitive with less and less regard for human life constantly.
Yes. Yes. So maybe it's worth shifting into some positive sides to this. And
sure.
I know you're involved in some boots on the ground type of stuff. So what are some initiatives you're taking? And ultimately, we've touched on helping men not only connect with their emotions, but connect with each other. What are some initiatives you're involved in right now?
So I've done a few things so far. I previously ran the only secular men's group in Pittsburgh, where we were teaching a lot of emotional skills to men. I am in the middle of creating an online version of this to a degree. I refer to this as inner strength training because to me, I think strength is determined in many ways by emotional relational factors. If you ask me what's harder, someone reaching a place where they can bench 300, which is extremely respectable, versus someone being able to stay grounded when they come home and their partner says to them, our child has an incurable disease. Like, the latter one's harder. It's in life, it's going to be the emotional things that hit you most. And sometimes they're going to hit you so hard, they knock you down. And you have to know how to be able to get back up in a healthy way, in a way that helps you and helps others to be around you so that you are still connected. And that's why I think radicalization is, we need to see it almost as a health threat for the men that it captures, because it ends up harming them too. In the same way that gang life can be great in the short term, but it's probably going to have a bad ending. But boots on the ground stuff, I've worked in different spaces as facilitators. I do my one-on-one work. I do group work. A new venture that I'm really curious about and trying to build up is, we will see what happens, but the way I have it currently mapped is doing lot clearing. So Pittsburgh is part of the Rust Belt, and we have a lot of lots, like dilapidated homes that are just overgrown, things are falling apart. And I used to do a lot of volunteering with a group called Team Rubicon, which was primarily made for veterans, but you come and you do demo work and for a week at a time. It's a fantastic organization, great mission. I love doing that. But the problem with Team Rubicon is you would go home and you would get depressed because you have this like high value time and then you go home and it's not there. Mm-hmm. Where this would just be local. So what I want to do is bring men together. It will probably be open to women too, but the focus will be on men. To, in the same way Team Rubicon's focused on veterans, but it's open to everyone, to do lot clearing, to get men engaged in their communities and to find a sense of purpose so that even what I want is us to be in a community that belongs or is connected to one of our members and someone come and say, this is great. This lot's never been cleared. Who's here? And for us to point and say, Steve over there is why you're here. If you want to tell us anything great, you tell Steve how great this is. And then if I really was to take this to the level in my mind, I'd want to. I'd want us to split time doing community work and personal relational work where let's say it's Steve's month, so to speak. So we say, Steve, where do you live? He says, I live in Hazelwood, which is a neighborhood in Pittsburgh. Great, Steve. We're going to come to Hazelwood. We're going to find a lot. We're going to clear it with the county and we're going to beautify this area so it's improved because better lots help for many reasons. They reduce violence because more people are out in the street. They like it better. It improves property values. It opens up new housing. There's many benefits. But Steve, we're going to help you help your community. And I want Hazelwood to think that you're great. And then Steve, later in this month, I want you to pick you or someone you're connected to who needs help. If we get a bunch of guys, 20 guys and a case of beer, and we have 6 hours, what do you need? Whether it's your father, your grandparents, or your girlfriends, or something that you're able to bring these guys and have them help. And for once again, for us to say, we are here because of Steve. Because I know if people would have come to my house when I was a kid, because I had some friends come and just do yard work, my dad would talk about them like they were God's gift for ages. Yeah. Man, did you see the work Alan did on those that edging and everything? That was amazing. He would talk about for months. And I would love for Steve to have the experience of my son Steve has such pull with these guys. Yeah. Look how great he is. And have people brag about him and Steve be able to receive that and feel connected with his family. If I had all of my resources, that's what I would be working on right now. And as part of this, we would have maybe an aspect of emotional skill building. Mm-hmm. But my goal would be to do a lot of this indirectly, to help people come together, to create space for honest conversations, to let men work together, to find purpose, to be connected with their communities. And I think a lot of the emotional stuff just comes with it because men do know how to connect. We just need space to. So the two big projects I'm working on right now are that and this, an online emotional skills course, which hopefully I will have up sometime in the near future. But there's so much else that can be done. You and I are both involved in an organization that's really striving to help people who want to help men in different ways. But this is what I got so far right now.
No, that's great. And to bring it all together, I know we touched on it in so many different ways around what people can do. But if we had to summarize coming out of this conversation, what are things people can do, not only to become aware of this potential for radicalization, but to build that sense of connection, to overcome the relational trauma that people may have experienced and connecting with each other? What are some things people can be aware of walking out of this?
I think the way I would frame this is we need to, one, think about social time in the same way we think about exercise. This is a need that needs to exist regardless of what else is happening in your life. It's just a human need that needs to be attended to. And so if it's not coming naturally, you need to manually put it here. Then if you are having a very hard time connecting with other people because of relational trauma, where you are holding a very deep assumption that if I'm around others, they will see the worst of me and reject me, that's when you need to go get some help. Work with one of us, find someone to work with who can help you repair this relationship with yourself, which to me, a lot of trauma work is very good at. I think you can do some managerial stuff with the CBT approach, but like to really sit with the feeling of it to me is a bit deeper and more effective approach. But the bottom line is if being around other people is very fear-inducing for you, there's help and resources for that. So get that because you need to be able to do that. And then finally is just to realize we need to accept that we are living in very uncertain times and we need to accept that our emotions are always under attack so that other people can profit off us, often just so they can show us more ads, which is such a just soulless way to destroy the world. But we just need to be aware these things are happening. And really, if you want to get out of that cycle, the best thing to do is to put down your phone and go outside and be around other humans and enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and I think... if you see someone going down a path that makes you nervous, connect with them and be curious about their emotions first before you try to correct them and offer them connection, even if you don't agree with them. And you don't have to. You just need to let them know they're not alone. And just be willing to spend time with them.
Yeah, no, I think that's powerful and empowering because to your point, it can feel lonely at times, but we're not alone in this and nor should we think that way. So I think it's important to emphasize that. James, what are some ways people can learn more about these initiatives or your work? I know you touched on it, but how can they find that stuff as much as you're telling people to disconnect and turn off their devices? They still... Yeah,
because I'm guilty of this. I don't have a social media presence because I haven't found, and I know I need one, or at least I'm constantly told I need one. This podcasting is how I've been the closest I can come to it because I like talking to people. So this is what works. There's not a social media page you can go to. The best way to get a hold of me is to contact me through my website. Okay. It's jamesjstamatellos.com. I'm sure it will be in the show notes because that's a very long Greek name to try to remember. But just come, drop me a message. If you're someone who's curious about working with me, cool. As a coach, I can work with pretty much anyone as long as we can work the language and time zones out. I'm not held by any boundaries or anything like that. But if you want to support this work and it's motivating you and you want to see if there's a way that you can help, please reach out to me as well, because I'm just figuring out how all this gets started and I will probably use whatever help I can get.
Awesome. Yeah, no, we'll definitely put that in the show notes. But James, thanks so much for your time today and having this conversation. It was such an honor to have you on.
Thank you so much for coming. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you for checking out this episode with James. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader. You can find the link to the newsletter in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.